From the Christian Research Institute in Charlotte, North Carolina, this is the Bible Answer Man broadcast with Hank Hanegraaff. We're on the air because truth matters, life matters more. On today's special edition of the Bible Answer Man, we pick up where we ended on our previous broadcast and present more of an episode of the Hank Unplugged podcast. Hank is talking with Nancy Piercy, professor of apologetics and scholar in residence at Houston Christian University, and author of The Toxic War on Masculinity, How Christianity Reconciles the Sexes. Let's now join Hank Hanegraaff and Nancy Piercy in their conversation.
I have quotes from many men saying, I never knew fatherhood would be so fulfilling, because we don't hear that today anymore. There's literally neurons in the brain that get activated when a man becomes a father. One psychologist calls it the dad brain. The dad brain is a nest of neurons that don't wake up unless you actually become a father. And so oxytocin is part of that. Yes, we've always been told that women's oxytocin rises during pregnancy. It turns out that a man's oxytocin also rises when he becomes a father, but he has to be actively holding and touching his child. It's stimulated by tactile sense. So if a father is actively holding his child, his oxytocin goes up as well. And which, you know, I know when I became a mother, I wanted all the help I could get. I was very thankful for this biochemical boost to help me become a better parent. And here's the really surprising thing. This is the most recent finding. It's by an anthropologist. And she found that the oxytocin in men goes up even during the wife's pregnancy. In other words, it doesn't wait until the baby's born. If the husband and wife are living together, his oxytocin goes up as well. I guess nobody ever thought to test a man's blood while his wife was pregnant. But when they did, they found out that men are being primed. God has equipped men to be primed to be a full member of the parenting team, biochemically primed all the way through his wife's pregnancy, as well as at the time of birth. So this was fascinating, because that's why so many men, do bond so closely with their children and do feel as if that's an important part of their manhood. Since the Industrial Revolution, we have pretty much taught men that they get their main identity from their work, from their career. And we have overlooked how much they do get a sense of a validation of their masculinity by becoming involved fathers as well.
Yeah, and that was just one of the 100, 200, 300, I don't know. I had so many aha moments reading through your book, and that certainly is at the top of the list. I got sort of a poignant question here, and that is, how has pornography impacted the idea of what it is to be a man?
Oh, it's had a tremendous influence. Unfortunately, boys are now exposed to pornography from about age 9. It's on their phone, it's in their music videos, it's everywhere. And some people put it this way, boys are getting their sex education from porn more than they are from school. And it's a very bad education. It is training them, of course, to see women as primarily objects of their sexual lust. It is training them to think that women like certain kinds of activities that most women don't like, that women find painful or demeaning. And I talk about it some in chapter 1. I deal with it more in my book, Love Thy Body, so I only touch on it in this book. But it is part of the way that boys are being brought up by our culture to be more toxic. We don't educate them in school, right? They're falling behind in education from kindergarten all the way through college and graduate school. By the way, I just saw a graph today. Colleges are about 60% female, 40% male now. When I started at Houston Christian University, by the way, it was 70-30. A lot of the smaller Christian colleges, right? 70-30. So we're working hard to change that. We brought in football and we brought in engineering to attract more male students. But more women than men are graduating from college. More women are graduating from graduate school and even professional schools like law and medicine. And so we're failing to educate boys. There are books out with titles like The War Against Boys, The Boy Crisis, Why Boys Fail. people are acknowledging that our society is failing boys. And I think the pornography fits into that. We're failing to train boys to be responsible, mature men who care about women and children, who are protective of women and children. And then we wonder why they turn out to have toxic behavior. It's because our culture is not training them up to be honorable, productive men.
If a man gets involved in pornography, gets addicted to pornography, can he have a proper or a successful relationship with a woman?
I don't think so. No, there's been so many studies on this. There was a Washington Post article that said, I don't care if pornography is moral or not. You know, it's a secular writer. Whether it's moral or not, it's a public health crisis. And the reason that the article called it a public health crisis is because pornography is training so many men in being abusive, in being violent. Something like 80% of the most watched porn involves violence. And so it is literally training men to associate sexual feelings with violence. And that's why this article called it a public health crisis, because it is training men to be violent and to be like Andrew Tate, if we want to bring in his, you know, so many young men are looking up to Andrew Tate, and it's turning out, of course, that he himself calls himself a pimp. That's his own word. And he himself says, I don't care about these women. I'm just using them as a means to make money. Well, I think that's a pretty good example of where porn is leading young men today, is they look up to men like Andrew Tate. So I think that pornography trains men so much, not only, well, violence is the worst, but even if it's not violent, it's seeing women primarily as receptacles for their lust. Let's face it, to be blunt. So no, I don't think that a man who's addicted to porn can have a good, healthy, biblical relationship with his wife.
Yeah, so many destructive sociological aspects that we could talk about in that regard. Thinking about aha moments, here's another stunner for me, also a stunner for researchers, that if you are a committed church-going man, the statistics for being anything but toxic are humongous. But if you're just a nominal Christian man, wow, you actually fit the stereotype of toxic masculinity.
Yes, this was amazing. And it really is the final reason I decided to write the book, when I saw the positive outcomes of committed Christian men. So this is material that's not really out in the public. I had to go digging into these academic literature to find these studies. So I cite about a dozen studies showing that committed Christian men actually test out as the most loving and engaged husbands and fathers. Let me preface that by saying this is very much counter to the cultural narrative. In writing the book, a quick Google search found lots and lots of quotes saying that evangelical men who believe in any form of male headship are, of course, going to turn out to be oppressive, domineering, tyrannical patriarchs. I'll give you just one quote. So this was the co-founder of the Church Too movement, which followed the Me Too movement. She said, the theology of male headship feeds the rape culture that we see permeating American Christianity today. So what happened is the psychologists, sociologists were reading these accusations and saying, well, where's your evidence? You know, you're making these charges, where's your data? And so they went and did the studies. And they found that, as you said, committed, you know, authentic Christian men who attend church regularly test out as the most loving husbands and fathers. And by the way, the first pushback I always get is, well, of course, their wives said they were happy. Their husbands are sitting right next to them. So you have to clarify, no, these are very large population-wide studies, not done by Christian organizations. You know, there's secular people and Islamic and Jewish, you know, these are very large thousands of people done by secular organizations, like the General Social Survey, for example. And then people, various researchers will come and take what they are interested out of that data. And so these weren't, most of the studies were not Christians running them. And the wives were interviewed separately. At any rate, so what they're reporting is that the wives say that they are the happiest with their husband's expression of love and affection. Evangelical fathers are the most engaged with their children, both in terms of shared activities like sports and church youth group, And in terms of discipline, like setting limits on screen time and enforcing bedtime, 3.5 hours per week more than the average American father. Evangelical couples are the least likely to divorce, and they have the lowest rate of domestic abuse and violence of any major group in America. And when I read this, I was blown away. I had no idea. I was reading the critics like all of us were. And I said, I've got to get this out. I have to get this out into the public. The church needs to know this, because the church needs to understand that men who are committed Christians are doing a good job. They need to stop having that scolding tone that I talked about earlier and start affirming and supporting men and letting them know that they're doing a good job. But the other side of the coin, as you mentioned, is nominal Christians.
Don't go away. In just a few moments, we'll rejoin Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with Professor Nancy Piercy. We often hear that Exhibit A of toxic behavior is evangelical Christian men. But recent sociological studies tell a very different story. These studies find that family men who attend church regularly test out as the most loving husbands and the most engaged fathers. They have the lowest rate of divorce and the lowest rate of domestic violence of any group in America. The Toxic War on Masculinity, How Christianity Reconciles the Sexes by Nancy Piercy, explodes anti-male stereotypes and shows that classic Christianity has the power to overcome toxic behavior and reconcile the sexes. To receive your copy of The Toxic War on Masculinity, just call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's mind-shaping, life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI. Or go online to equip.org. That's equip.org.
If you're not horrified, you should be. Because the relentless assaults of wokeism on sanity and common sense have now reached a fevered pitch. In fact, some astute observers see more than deranged ideologies at work. It's as though the gates of hell have been opened. And alarmingly, the speed of this mindless rush to chaos and potential civilizational collapse is gaining momentum daily. That means Christians need to wake up, and wake up fast. One of the best alarm clocks is the upcoming special Woke edition of the Christian Research Journal. It contains sobering articles with penetrating analyses of a social disease that is reaching a flashpoint. To receive your copy of this special edition of the Christian Research Journal, visit equip.org. That's equip.org. Or call 888-7000-CRI. That's 888-7000-CRI.
Bertrand Russell famously said, "Most people would rather die than think, and many of them do." Not so with CRI support team members. Support team members are not only serious thinkers, but their membership in CRI's support team helps to equip hundreds of thousands of fellow believers around the globe each and every month. Are you not a member? Then you're missing out. Not only do support team members form the backbone of Christian Research Institute's outreaches, but they enjoy their selection of resources from our Equipping Essentials library. To discover how you can make a difference 24/7 in equipping believers at home and abroad to stand for life and truth, check out the benefits of membership at equip.org. Once again, that's equip.org.
Truth Matters, Life Matters More by Hank Hanegraaff is essentially two books in one. Because Truth Matters, Part 1 equips Christians to defend the essential truths of the historic Christian faith. In Part 2, Hank explains why life matters more and how we can experience the height of human existence, union with God in Christ. Simply put, the map is not the territory, the menu is not the meal. We cheat ourselves of authentic union with Christ when we elevate the message above the Messiah. Truth Matters, Life Matters More is a modern classic and the magnum opus of one of the great theological minds of our time. To receive Truth Matters, Life Matters More, simply call 888-7000-CRI. and make a gift in support of the life-changing work of the Christian Research Institute. That's 888-7000-CRI or go online to equip.org.
Let's rejoin Bible Answer Man host Hank Hanegraaff and his guest, Professor Nancy Piercy, in their conversation.
The church needs to understand that men who are committed Christians are doing a good job. But the other side of the coin, as you mentioned, is nominal Christians. So nominal means in name only. My students don't even know what the term means, so I have to explain to them. Nominal Christians, one of the most widely quoted statistics among Christian leaders, as you no doubt know, is that Christians divorce at the same rate as the rest of the culture. So the researchers went back to the data and they did make that crucial distinction between committed Christians and nominal Christians. And as you said, the nominal Christians are shockingly different. They do fit all the toxic stereotypes. Their wives report the lowest level of happiness. They report the lowest level of engagement with their children. They have the highest rate of divorce, higher than secular men. And they have the highest rate of domestic abuse and violence, even higher than secular men. So this is why the statistics get so skewed, you know, because you have men who are better than secular men and men who are worse than secular men. So if you just do a broad-based discussion of evangelicals, of course, the numbers are going to be misleading. And it does suggest, again, what the church needs to do. Support the men who are doing a good job. Be aware that they are. You know, encourage them. They feel as beaten down as any other men do. But also, I think we need better programs to reach out to these men who are kind of at the fringes of the Christian world, who are claiming the identity of evangelical, and who we might say are ruining the reputation of evangelicals, because they're taking biblical language like headship and submission, but infusing it with meaning from the secular script for masculinity, infusing it with definitions like dominance, entitlement, control, and so on. And I sometimes have people ask me, well, but why are they worse than secular men if they're taking their definitions from the secular world? Well, it's because they're feeling like they have religious permission to act that way, right? So the secular person can be an abusive husband, say, but he doesn't have religious justification. The nominal Christian feels he has religious permission to act that way. And so he ends up actually having the worst of both worlds and being worse than secular men. So that's what we're up against in the church. We have the best and the worst, and we have to figure out a good strategy for dealing with men within the church.
Yeah, which you do in the book. And in chapter 3, titled The Paradox of Christian Marriage, What Christians Really Think About Headship, you just alluded to this. But elaborate on that, because there's such a stereotypical narrative about what headship actually entails. It's completely divorced from the real biblical understanding or the Christian understanding of headship.
Yes, I was surprised again, because this is all coming out of, you know, hard data, you know, empirical research, rigorous testing. I don't know if you know this, but when my book first appeared, like the day after the book appeared, it was viciously attacked by Christian egalitarians. I don't know, if you're not on Twitter, you may not have noticed this. They took over my whole Twitter page for days, for weeks. And this was interesting because I don't even debate the egalitarian complementarian issue in my book. I don't, because I'm not interested in these in-house debates. Well, there's two reasons. One is two of my top researchers say that in practice, it doesn't seem to make much difference. This was fascinating. So Brad Wilcox is considered, he's at the University of Virginia. He's considered like the top marriage sociologist in the country. And his conclusion from his research was, I've tested men who are egalitarian and I've tested men who are complementarian. And he said, complementarian men are not abusive. They do test out as the happiest, the most engaged, loving husbands and fathers. By the way, he's Catholic. So in a sense, he didn't have a dog in this fight, because I don't know that he was happy to find out that evangelical Protestant men test out on top at the highest level. And he tested egalitarian marriages and he said, they're not any happier. They don't test out as happier. And then there's a top marriage psychologist in the country, John Gottman. And he said the same thing. He said, I have people coming into my practice. Some of them believe the man should be in charge of his marriage. And I have people come in who are very egalitarian. And he said, you know, here's how he put it. Emotionally intelligent husbands have figured out the most important thing, which is how to convey honor and respect to your wife. Their gender theory does not seem to make a difference. So I just quoted that and said, okay, this is why I'm not going to deal with this question in my book. And then the first several weeks of the book was out, I got, you know, the book got dragged into that debate by Christian egalitarians. The second reason that I don't do it is because I have an apologist, right? So I want to counter the secular charges. The secular world says, if you are an evangelical conservative Christian, you will be a domineering, abusive patriarch. And so I thought, well, let's find out. Let's look at these studies that were done of evangelical men. What do they say? And so chapter three is all pretty much all just quotes from Christian men and women saying what they think headship means. And once again, I was blown away by how loving and respectful their understanding of headship was. They did not define it primarily in terms of breadwinner or final authority or tiebreaker, some of the things we normally hear. They defined the most common phrase was spiritual leadership, spiritual leader. And if you press them, well, what do you mean by that? They would start with the most obvious practical things. Get your family to church on Sunday, get your kids to youth group, have family devotions, have family prayers. But it also was the less tangible things like being responsible for the spiritual life and welfare of your wife and children. And so I quoted a secular sociologist saying, wait a minute, how can you believe in headship and equal worth at the same time? Well, Christians have figured out how to do that. Yes, there's a headship in terms of a special kind of responsibility for the husband, but they don't think that that means that husband and wife have differing worth, that women are inferior or subordinate. They do believe that they're both made in God's image and clearly have the same spiritual status. So chapter three is just quoting Christian couples, showing what they think headship means. And I personally, I didn't expect it to be that positive. It was very, very positive.
Yeah, it's about responsibility, not privilege.
Yeah, that was a nice summary.
Yeah, so you say that Christian marriage was historically revolutionary, and then you expand on that in the book. And I think that is very eye-opening for our audience to hear. It's hard for people to go back, let's say, to first century Rome and see how women were treated within that context and how Christianity comes into that context and liberates women, exalts women. You know, obviously, Christ is the quintessential example of taking women and giving women significant roles. I mean, they're his entourage. They're part of his inner circle. Mary is the quintessence of theosis. I mean, she's everything that we hope to be. So marriage from a Christian standpoint was revolutionary to the culture. It was countercultural.
Yeah, it's difficult for us to make this point with our secular friends because Christianity has become the wallpaper, right? They don't realize how much our views of women and the value, dignity, significance of women has come from Christianity. So you get that perspective better if you go back to the first century. And what was the early church facing? Well, in Roman culture, women had very little status, very little value. Women were expected, well, marriage was to produce legal heirs, but there was not any expectation that there would be any real love and affection between husband and wife. Women were often married off as age 12 or 13. So they were much younger than their husbands. They had much less education. And it was almost more like marrying a child, right? As a result, husbands and wives had very little in common. And women were seen as inferior. Well, because they were so much younger. Men, it was totally socially acceptable for men to have sex with just about anybody. Prostitutes, courtesans, mistresses, and most of all, their slaves. Slaves were the most common. Both male and female, both adult and children. Pedophilia was a big part of it. And in fact, as you know, unwanted children were often put out. It was called exposed. They were exposed. They were put out to be, you know, killed by the wild beast or by the elements. Those children are sometimes rescued and raised in brothels to be sex slaves. So in this context, abortion and infanticide were committed primarily against baby girls. It was rare, historians tell us, it was rare for a Roman family to have more than one daughter. They would have a token girl, but that was it. Any more girls would be, again, killed or aborted. And abortion was a big killer of women too. If you insisted, there were some famous cases of people who insisted that, you know, they'd had sex outside of marriage, and so they insisted that the woman have an abortion. And abortion was a big killer of women at that time. So all that to say that when Christianity came on the scene and said, you need to be faithful in marriage, that was not a huge message for women, but it was revolutionary for men. Men were like shocked. What do you mean? We can't have sex outside of marriage.
We'll have to stop here for today's special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast. Join us again next time when we'll continue Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with Professor Nancy Piercy. Our firm commitment here at the Christian Research Institute is to defend the faith once for all delivered to the saints and equip believers to become true disciples of Jesus Christ. In appreciation for your vital gift to help strengthen and expand CRI's mind-shaping, life-changing outreaches, Hank would like to send you a copy of The Toxic War on Masculinity, How Christianity Reconciles the Sexes by Nancy Piercy. Call a resource consultant at 888-7000-CRI, 888-7000-CRI, or visit our website, equip.org. Once again, that's equip.org. You can also write CRI at Post Office Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, zip code 28271. The Bible Answer Man broadcast is funded by listeners like you. We're on the air because truth matters, life matters more.
If you thought the pandemic was scary, it may actually pale in comparison to today's pandementia. We're talking about wokeism and its growing legions of followers who have defiantly and dangerously declared their independence from reality. That's right. For those infected by the woke virus, anytime their ideology encounters reality, ideology wins. To help halt the advance of this deadly social and mental disease, you'll want a copy of the upcoming special edition of the Christian Research Journal. In it, you'll feast on penetrating analyses and criticisms of one of the most dangerous ideologies in modern history, all written to help you grasp just how deranged this tyrannical movement actually is. To receive your copy, visit equip.org, that's equip.org, or call 888-7000-CRI, that's 888-7000-CRI.